Good evening, everybody. I'm Donna Cease. I'm our spiritual programs coordinator here. And I'm happy and sad. Happy that we get to have another evening of teachings with Don, but a little bit sad because it's his last night with us. Just a couple of quick protocol things. If you are familiar with when Geshla teaches, then you know that when the teacher enters the room, we stand out of respect for the teachings that the teacher holds. With Geshla, he departs a little bit from usual protocol and requests that he requests that we prostrate with him. If you are choosing to do prostrations tonight, we'll go ahead and wait until Don is seated and then do our prostrations. And it's totally optional whether you wish to do that. And again, the prostrations are just an antidote to pride and again, a sign of respect for the teacher and the teachings. Couple of little announcements. We have a big party coming up Saturday celebrating our 25 years of existence as Kadampa Center. Jill has been very busy getting ready for it, and she needs some folks to come in at 10 a.m. on Saturday to help out. There's a little bit of moving stuff around. She said you didn't have to be a big, burly, strong person, but it does involve a little bit of physical work. Also, Sakadawa, which is a major Buddhist holy day, is coming on Friday. And we have a very full calendar. We'll have 8 Mahayana precepts at 5:15 in the morning. That's just a 24-hour set of vows. At noon, we will have Medicine Buddha Puja. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon is an animal blessing and liberation that the nuns are going to be leading. And then in the evening, Geshla is offering refuge vows. You need to have already registered for that, but he offers refuge vows most years. He will also offer lay vows and the bodhisattva vows. So you're welcome to come for those. And if you've taken refuge before, you're welcome to come and renew your refuge vows if you wish to. Another very big thing that we have coming up in July, on July 6th, which is His Holiness's birthday, we're preparing a gift for him of a Compassion in Action, and we are hosting a blood drive right here at the center. So I hope that you will consider whether this is something that you can offer to another person. It's kind of a gift of life, and we want to be able to tell His Holiness about this gift that we have prepared for him when he comes in October. So we have information on our website about it, and you need to go to the Red Cross website to register for it. Last but not least, everything we offer at Kadampa Center is offered on a donation basis. We've grown over 25 years, not charging people to come in the door, because we find these teachings really, really precious. So if you are moved by what you hear tonight and want to help supporting us in continuing to make teachings like this available, we'd appreciate any donation. And there's a box right outside the Gampa door that you can put your donation in. And I think that's it. Don should be with us in just a moment. Thank you. Oh, and tonight is on using work as a spiritual practice, which is helpful.
Good evening, everyone. Let's start tonight with the prayers we did last night as well. Again, this is a bit more of a public talk topic, but certainly we're looking at the Buddha's teachings, trying to apply them in our working life tonight, looking at that more specifically. So page 35, we'll do what's called the seven-limb prayer. As I mentioned last night, this is a really useful way to create some positive potential. And whatever your relationship is to the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, these three jewels, you kind of can think that we're engaging in these various activities, these seven limbs of prostrating, offering, confession, rejoicing, requesting to remain, and requesting to teach, and then finally dedicating and trying to create some good positive potential, purify any of our obscurations, obstacles that we have in our minds. So let's recite these together. Reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. And we'll continue with this short mandala offering prayer. Again, this is about creating this vast, pure offering, the entire phenomenal universe purified into a beautiful realm for ourselves and all beings to enjoy. We think of it as a Buddha field, and we're offering it to receive the greatest blessings from these teachings through the power of the Buddha. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandalakam Niryatayami. And then finally, just one more prayer on page 98. This is just affirming our own sense of safe direction or refuge in the Three Jewels and our own desire to use this opportunity that we have together tonight to create the causes for our own enlightenment and the enlightenment of all beings. So let's recite this three times in English, the Refuge and Bodhicitta prayer. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. Okay, you can set the prayer books aside now, and let's just do a short meditation, give ourselves a chance to come more fully into this space, to focus our minds a bit. So again, if you have a technique that you prefer to use in regard to meditating on the breath, you can use that. If not, just you can follow the instructions that I'm going to give. That is another way of working with the breath. But first, just check your posture. Make sure that you're settled into a nice upright posture with the body relaxed. You can close your eyes if you wish. Otherwise, just keep the eyelids slightly open. This might be useful, particularly in the evenings when you might be a little tired from the day. Begin to pay attention to the breath. Again, if you have another technique, you can use that. If not, just tune into that sensation that occurs just inside the tip of the nose. As you breathe in, as you breathe out, that subtle sensation that occurs just inside the nostrils. And the basic instruction is simply to stay present with that through each cycle. But no doubt the mind will wander. It's prone to wander. And we see that that's happened, that suddenly we're thinking about things that are on our minds currently, making plans, remembering things of the past, maybe even getting distracted by sounds and so on. When we see that that's happened, there's no need for any judgment. We simply let that go, make that decision to just simply return our attention back to the breath, to not continue to follow whatever it was that distracted the mind. So I'll ring the chime. We'll do this in silence for just a few minutes, and then I'll lead you in a short reflection to begin our exploration of this topic tonight. So now with our minds a bit more settled, a bit more focused, let's start by generating our motivation for being here. We've all come here tonight to explore this topic of how we use our work, how we earn a living, as a means to increase our spiritual path, to utilize what we're learning in terms of our spirituality. I think that you're here to explore this topic tonight, initially because you can see that there will be greater benefit to yourself if you're able to do that. But then also think about all the people that you interact with in your job. Or if you're not working at this time, those that perhaps you interact with in terms of volunteer work that you do, or other ways that you are involved in the world. Even those in your life more directly, your family, friends, and so on. And think that you're here to increase your own ability so that you can be a greater resource for all those individuals in your life, so that you can bring them greater peace, help them to know deeper happiness, help them to not suffer. So in this way, to enlarge upon one's own concern, to include concern for others as well. This is already part of using our work life as a spiritual path. But just to hold that thought and think that's why you're here tonight. And then to be kind of moving in the direction of what we're going to be exploring tonight, I just want you to examine, you know, how you think of your inner life right now, what we might call our spiritual life. What is the current relationship between that and what you think of as your outer life? Again, if you're working, then you might think about your job and how you are in regard to those hours of your day. And what is the relationship between your inner life and that aspect of your outer life? If you're not working, then again, you can think about those activities that you're primarily engaged in and ask yourself that same question. How are these two related? How is my inner life, my inner world, related to my outer expression through my job, through school, through whatever activities I'm engaged in? And just contemplate that for a moment or two. Okay. So I'd like to see if anyone wanted to share anything from that brief reflection, if there was anything that came up for anybody, any observations. Anyone? And if you do want to say something, just put your hand up and yeah, Susie will bring the microphone by. No one? Yes. What's your name, by the way?
Joan.
Joan. Hi, Joan.
I don't think there's a separation between the two. I don't
Good.
See that.
Wonderful.
It's all just part of every moment, every day.
Wonderful. Maybe I'll let you teach this.
Not at all.
No, it's wonderful. If you can have that observation and feel that that's where you're at, that's terrific. It's a bit of what we're going to be exploring tonight is how to bring those two together so that they're seamless. It's not like there's a differentiation between one and the other. So that's good. Wonderful. Thanks, Joan. Anyone else? Any observations on kind of your... Again, inner life and outer life, if it's more comfortable thinking in those terms. Some of you, again, might not be working or have other aspects to your life, but is there a differentiation? Is there a relationship? Where are they at? Anyone? Yes, Jeff. right behind you there. Yeah.
I just know that, I know 2 years ago I started on this path and I hit it hard, and work was easier. People around me responded to me better. And I'll just be honest, last year I didn't do squat on the path.
Uh-huh.
And I got talked to at work like this.
Uh-huh.
And now, I don't know, the last 4 months I'm hitting it medium hard again.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden people are like, yeah, you're cool again. You know, so it's totally, when I'm working it, there is no, when it works, yeah. When I'm working it and conscious of it, it's like when you hit a baseball off a bat and you don't feel that.
Right.
You know, it's just smoother, everything from yeah. inside and outside.
Yeah.
So
you're in the zone. Yeah. Good. Thanks, Jeff. I think that's probably when we've had those moments, or if we have it all the time. I mean, that's really what it should feel like. And that mm-hmm. there's no differentiation. Part of the inspiration for doing this talk, this is one similar to the one I did last night that actually didn't give the full history of where these talks came from. At Thupten Norbu Ling, the center in the FPMT that I teach at in Santa Fe, there was a point in my beginning Dharma career where I was doing a lot of teachings on the traditional texts and what have you, and I wanted to try to explore more practical teachings. And we put together a series of classes that I called The Heart of Practice, which is kind of taking all the principles that we learn when we're going through the stages of the path and all these other more structured teachings, and just talking about, well, what do they look like when the rubber hits the road, when we're actually out living our lives. Not that there should, again, be a difference between those, but sometimes it's hard to make the leap from what you're learning about in the Discovering Buddhism or the Lam Rim to how you live your daily life. So this was one of the topics that I was inspired to do, in part by the book that I'm going to draw a bit from, because Lewis Richman wrote a wonderful book that's called Work as a Spiritual Practice, I think is the name of it. Yes. And there's, I think it's in your library. There's a few copies that they picked up for the bookstore. It's a nice book and very, very relevant. And he's a wonderful writer. He's written a book recently on aging as a spiritual practice, which some of us in the room might feel is very appropriate, but we're all aging. So it's an interesting topic too. I've taught on that and used some of his ideas as well as some other things to talk about aging and how we make sure that that part of our life is also a spiritual practice. But the other kind of teaching article that I came across on the internet is by a gentleman named Steve Pavlina, who I've mentioned before. Not particularly Buddhist, but he's got some interesting thinking. And he wrote an article that's called Living Congruently. And I really like the way that he started. He was saying, you know, that we tend to have lives that are very compartmentalized. And we think about, okay, here's my spiritual life, and here's my family life, and here's my social life in terms of my friends, and here's my work life. And we have all these little kind of like balls that we're juggling that are all somewhat distinct and unique. We're the common thread through all of that, obviously. But yet we tend to see them as different parts of our life. And we might even find that we're living by different guidelines when it comes to each of those. So that what's guiding us when we're in our spiritual life, when we're doing more focused practice in terms of being here, part of the community, being on our cushion, meditating, what have you, or our study and so on, that we feel like we're a different person than when we put on all of our work clothes and go running off to the job, and then we have to deal with different situations, different people. And so it seems like a real divide. And those of you who've been able to create some of that seamlessness between those are actually doing what Steve Pavlina calls living congruently, living kind of with everything coming together in a very profound way. I'm going to read just a little bit about what he says in this article. He says, are we supposed to live like a collection of parts or as an integrated whole? I wondered whether it would be possible to live in such a way where there was only one set of rules governing all areas, essentially meaning that I followed my deepest spiritual beliefs in all matters. This line of questioning led me to discover just how it might be possible for all these different parts of my life to become a single integrated whole. This would mean that my business and my conscience and my interpersonal relationships were all one. There would be no sense of separation. So again, I think that this is, you know, what we're aiming for by this type of exploration tonight. We may not feel like we can accomplish it immediately, but to recognize that if we live our lives like that, it is very disjointed then. And there's not going to be a consistency in terms of any strength behind any one of those. And if we are genuinely trying to practice a spiritual path, to work the path, as Jeff says, well then, it is important that we make as much of our life into the spiritual path as we can. And not feel like we're only spending those few moments, minutes, hours, whatever we have, doing more concentrated spiritual practice as what we call our spiritual life. That rather our spiritual life is wherever we're at, whatever we're doing. So again, if we're going to explore it in the context of work, but everything I'm going to look at in terms of the methodology that Lewis Richmond uses to examine this is totally applicable to any aspect of your life. I mean, you could apply the same thing to personal relationships, intimate relationships. You can apply it to family life. You can apply it to anything. Because we're going to have the same sort of common types of things going on. So this is a sort of introduction to this in terms of how we're going to be pursuing this tonight. I think the very first thing that we have to look at is what do we mean by a spiritual path? If we say tonight the topic is using work as a spiritual path, well, what does that mean? I've mentioned this in some of the other teachings I've done here. If we say, well, what does practicing a spiritual path look like? In Buddhist terms, it looks like doing two things. And really, we could boil all the path down to two things. One is diminishing the negative states of mind. In fact, if we follow the Buddhist path to its conclusion, we eventually eliminate all the negative. You will be able to get rid of everything that is destructive, that gets in the way, that causes conflict. All of this can be removed completely. But, you know, slowly, slowly, we just do what we can to begin to address that. That's a part of our spiritual path. The other part of our spiritual path is enhancing and developing everything that we find that is positive. These are all the things that create bonds between us and others, that create harmony, that cause us to feel more engaged in the world and the people that we are with, feel us more engaged in life in general. So this is, again, we have the potential to do these to limitless degrees, to take everything absolutely away that is negative, to enhance everything that is positive, to an exponential degree that we can't even imagine right now. But again, just to begin that process, through using everything that we encounter in that way, you know, living congruently, having everything be an extension of what we're trying to practice on our spiritual path. And of course, the Buddha's arena for doing that work is our minds. It's not the outside world, and we might even be practicing some of what we're learning tonight and find that the outside world doesn't change as much. Maybe we're working the path, but the outside world stays the same. Everyone is still just as irritable. Everyone is still, you know, doing all the things that bothered us in the first place. But our minds have changed. We're no longer as sensitive to it. We're able to utilize it as a means to develop the qualities that we want. So it really comes down to spiritual practice, meaning to work with our minds in this way, to increase those that are positive, the states of mind and qualities that we're seeking, and then to diminish those that are negative. And that's really, once more, an extension of everything that we're learning as part of our Buddhist path. Lewis Richmond, and just to share what he says about this, he says, the true intent of a spiritual practice is not about mechanically obeying rules, but developing an awareness of the sacred. This is his words, very nice words, a bit more poetic than what I just shared with you, of an awareness of the sacred. You know, we all have the sacred within us, the Buddha says. We might call this our Buddha nature, our Buddha potential. So our job on the path is to continually do what we can to increase our own awareness of that, to get more and more in touch with what is wholesome and positive in that regard, to get better and better at confronting what obscures that, what keeps us from being in touch with that sacred nature that we each have. So however we look at our path, it's very similar ideas, you know, regardless of the words that we put on this, we're really talking about working with our minds to create a change in our experience. Now part of tonight, what I'm going to be moving from here, I do want to touch first of all on just a little bit of what I shared over the weekend in regard to our livelihood. And why I share that is simply because in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, I don't know that we talk about livelihood quite so much. And I do want to share a few points that I raised over the weekend that I think they come from the Theravadan traditions and how they look at right livelihood, skillful livelihood as one of the eightfold paths that I went through over the weekend. So I do want to give some background on that simply because, again, most of us might not hear those sorts of teachings as much in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. The second thing that I'm going to do is go into the diagram that I have up here on the board that I hope most of you can see. This is what we call the energy wheel, and this is what Lewis Richmond says is some Buddhist ideas sort of formulated into this schema for looking at our day, looking at what's going on in our lives, particularly in the work environment, and seeing them all as opportunities to do something to make the most out of wherever we're at. And I'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to that. The final thing is I do want to share some things from our tradition in terms of what Lama Zopa says about our attitude for work, a few points that he makes that I think are really useful. Because, you know, we're in this tradition of FPMT, and Rinpoche, in his kindness, is always giving us amazing advice on how we can utilize the Mahayana teachings in our lives in regard to all the various facets. So I'll share a little bit of that. So any questions up to this point, just to check in? Are you all here with that, what I just described as something you'd like to explore, hopefully? Okay, good. So let's go ahead and start with just a little bit about what is meant by right livelihood or correct livelihood. Again, in this tradition, and I was mentioning to somebody after teachings the other day, that there's one teacher, Alex Berzin, in our tradition, who actually said his teacher never said anything about some of these sorts of things, and it didn't seem that there was much distinction in terms of the type of work that one does. Rather, in this tradition, we tend to focus on maybe some deceptive ways that we gain our living. But other than that, the nature of our work wasn't so much an issue, at least from that Tibetan Buddhist teacher. I don't know if it was Zong Rinpoche. I can't remember his teacher's name. Tsergkang Rinpoche, perhaps. Anyway, his teacher basically said, "Doesn't matter what you do in terms of what the occupation is and the business is. It matters more whether you're staying true to some sort of inner principles around making sure that you're not involved in deceiving others for your livelihood." Nonetheless, in the Theravadan tradition, as I mentioned, they do talk about occupations that are probably not so helpful to our spiritual practice because the nature of that job or of that business is probably not the most wholesome thing. So they encourage, and I'm just going to share this with you, this is from the book that we used as a resource somewhat through the weekend, from the Theravadan tradition by Henapola Gunaratana, that's called 8 Mindful Steps to Happiness. And in that book, he talks about a threefold inquiry that we can make in regard to our employment and kind of look at those and see whether there's something there in any of these three steps that is a stop sign for us that maybe we need to examine and say, perhaps I need to change something. The point of any of this investigation is not that you absolutely have to change what you're doing, but rather to recognize that there may be some occupations where the challenges might be greater by virtue of what you're doing or what you have to encounter, the types of tasks and activities that you need to do in your job. So the very first question that he says is my job by nature a wrong occupation? Which we would essentially define in terms of what the Buddha calls, you know, ahimsa is our principle that we always want to follow, which is non-harmfulness. So if a job is sort of wrong by nature, a wrong occupation by nature, it means it's something that causes harm to others or to ourselves. So frequently the occupations that are businesses that are pointed out here are, you know, weapons manufacturers, poison manufacturers, various things that would be used potentially, not all the time, but usually used to cause harm to other beings. Eric the other night who asked about, you know, somebody who is involved in laboratory work where they're in, you know, rats or monkeys or whatever are being killed or harmed in order to research various medicines or what have you. Those sorts of occupations, again, we're not kind of saying they're absolutely wrong, but rather that there is a flavor to them that can be problematic sometimes because our living is coming from those means. Now, again, we're in a very wide world with many different connections between companies, between businesses, between so many aspects of our world. It's very hard to kind of feel like you're completely isolated and in some little wholesome category of making your living that doesn't have anything to do with anyone else's wrong occupation. But this may be a stopping point for some people where we might have to say, well, is this something I want to continue to be involved in? Particularly if it's something that you have to do, which is really the second investigation that we need to do, is does your job require you that you do those sorts of activities, such as killing animals, harming animals, lying, doing any of these of what we frequently call the five lay precepts, the moral precepts that we all try to follow as Buddhists, which are essentially not killing, not stealing, not engaging in unwise sexual behavior, which means adultery. I don't know that anyone has an occupation in the room that has to do with that. The fourth one would be not lying. And then the fifth one would be avoiding alcohol and intoxicants. So it was interesting when I lived in San Francisco, I had a friend who was a bartender, and we were having dinner one night, and a friend of mine asked him, you know, so you must deal with a lot of alcoholics. And he says, actually, I create them. I mean, this was his perspective as a bartender. And, I mean, he could see it, but he didn't have any desire to move away from it. He wasn't in a place where he saw it as problematic. But if you're a bartender, I mean, you are engaged in getting people to drink more alcohol. Again, wait 1 second. Naga, get the microphone coming to you.
Sorry. There is one Buddhist, I think, in... I don't know where he's from, but he in Japan. I think he works in, he opened a bar so that people would come and talk to him because they are more vulnerable when they drink and they open more.
Skillful means, yeah. I mean, there may be those situations where there's actually skillful means in doing that, but I'd say probably most people who work in a bar may not have that objective. They're there to make money and maybe to even keep their customers very happy because they'll get more tips from them and so on. So, you know, again, it's great. There's, you know, a useful example to look at where, again, it's not absolute. I'm not saying that there's any absolutism around any of this, because even with this investigation we've done so far, is it a wrong occupation in a sense, something that's harmful, not as beneficial perhaps as other occupations? Is it something that causes me to break these moral precepts? It doesn't mean that you walk away from that job. It might mean that you have to stay there, I mentioned this over the weekend, perhaps with the intention of moving people in a more positive direction. If you have a company that frequently does things that are not so good in terms of their ways of doing business, maybe you can be a positive influence on that. By your being there, there might be a greater effect in a positive way on them and how the business is run. Whereas if you're not there at all, then they're going to continue doing what they're doing, and the people who work for them aren't going to question it. So this investigation isn't to say, oh, well, you know, I went to the class the other night and I found out that I have to quit my job and get another job. No, that's your investigation, and I think you have to be real careful in terms of making decisions, because you might have many people who depend upon your income. And if you do something that is, you know, not as good a pay or whatever, you might have effects upon people who you care about by virtue of changing your occupation. But rather, you might use this as a way of alerting yourself to those things that you need to be real careful about in regard to your job. The third one is the most interesting one, I think, which is the way he words this is, are there other aspects of my job that disturb me and keep my mind from settling down? In other words, what's the effect of the work that you do on your state of mind? Now, we're going to be exploring in this next topic of the energy wheel how we can work with our minds in regard to whatever is going on. But nonetheless, some of us may have jobs that the stress level and the various factors that we have to deal with make it almost impossible for that to happen. And if that's your situation, then perhaps, you know, you're like, right in the midst of the boiling water, and you need to remove yourself from the boiling water and find a cooler pool to, you know, play in for a while. Maybe when you have greater skill, you can go back to the boiling water. But again, this is an individual investigation to say what goes on in my day-to-day life that makes it really, really difficult for me to practice, to keep my mind clear, to feel like I'm, you know, in touch with all of that. And that may be, again, an impetus for us to do something more, such as engaging in these teachings we're going to look at, or it might cause us to re-examine where we are working and think that perhaps there is a better place where we'll have a bit more calm, a bit more ability to work with our minds and so on. But again, that's extremely individual. And I think that's, you know, again, the work that all of you can do if that is something that you're finding by looking at this threefold investigation. Now, if we don't have a right livelihood, if those factors kind of aren't in place, or if we're engaged in certainly deceitful and other behavior, well, karmically, the Buddha says that this is a part of our karma, that you, by virtue of your intention, being there, being a part of that occupation, being doing that in your job, this is all the karma that you're creating through your own mental movement, through the actions that follow from that, what we say, what we do. So there are, of course, karmic consequences of that. But it's also, again, as I explored over the weekend, right livelihood is part of the foundation of having sort of a good morality. That becomes a foundation for having good concentration. That becomes a foundation for developing deep wisdom. So we might find other aspects of our spiritual path to be lacking if we don't have good morality when it comes to our livelihood and how we are in the world. So it's just to have that mindfulness, that awareness that our livelihood is important, is not something that we just completely ignore or think it doesn't matter, because it is a good part of our lives. For many of us, it's maybe the bulk of our lives. So any questions on that first presentation in terms of skillful or correct livelihood? Yes, right behind you there, Susie. And what's your name?
My name's David.
Hi, David.
So it's a kind of a two-part question. One, so like if you had a restaurant and you served alcohol, and so you weren't really serving it, so you just owned the restaurant.
Right.
That could be a bad thing. So, but does it matter as the restaurant owner whose restaurant is serving alcohol, if you think it's bad, then it's worse, or if you don't think it's bad, it doesn't matter. So, I mean, is there the implication of how you feel about it?
Well, again, when we talk about alcohol in particular, maybe I should have made this a little bit clearer earlier too, that is the only one of the five precepts that isn't by nature something wrong.
Let's say tobacco. So, let's say you're a tobacco farmer or something. Something that is really can be harmful for people, that creates addiction and stuff.
Right. Yeah, tobacco is probably a better example of something that doesn't really have, I mean, there are probably
you're
some uses.
You're a tobacco farmer and you don't eat, you're just growing it, you're not selling it, you're not pushing it, you're not producing it, but yet you know tobacco is not good.
Right. Again, I think that there's something, again, that might be part of that, but we do have to go back to, again, your knowledge of whether, if it's something that is by nature wrong. And again, the Buddha did say that there are some acts by nature that they have that flavor to them. Killing is an example, you know, and stealing and so on, these that we normally highlight. Those acts in and of themselves have that nature of being a negative act. They, in rare situations on the Bodhisattva path, it said you can transform even a negative into a positive by virtue of having a good intention, a bit of what Naga was sharing in terms of someone being having a bar where they're serving people, but they're also trying to teach the Dharma to them as they're coming in the door. So there are situations where, again, if it's not by nature wrong, and it's hard to say in some of these situations exactly what we mean by nature, because it gets quite complicated.
I was just curious, because I've always thought that, alcohol, not that I don't use it, but it in some people it's really bad, and I would never want to be in a position where I sold it to those people.
Sure. Sure.
But I was wondering if, how that plays in.
And I think that's good for you to have that perspective. And certainly if you're practicing Buddhism and you're trying to, have some respect for your own mind as well as for the minds of others, it might be good to distance yourself from that type of behavior. Nonetheless, again, drinking alcohol by itself is not a natural misdeed.
Right.
That's the only of the five precepts that we take that actually is said to be a prescribed one in terms of the Buddha formulated that as a misdeed. And why is because we know from our own experience that when we're inebriated, our morals can potentially loosen. So suddenly we're doing things that we didn't intend to do, that we might not have done had we not taken alcohol or other intoxicants. So again, I think that it becomes a little complicated in that regard. Restaurants, if you talk about a restaurant that serves alcohol, I mean, your primary business is the restaurant, is to provide people with food, and people like a beverage with their food, and they do need to drink something. You're allowing people to have access to alcohol, which, again, is not a natural misdeed. You've got lobsters in the tank out front, you know, and their animals are being killed on the site. Well, that's maybe a little bit closer to being involved with the death of beings, but I don't know. I mean, it gets quite complex. And the karma of meat, which we talked about over the weekend, I don't want to necessarily open that bag of worms or whatever, just a can of worms and start going down that avenue. But the act of eating meat is a distinct act from killing a being. The karma of it is, many teachers have different views on the karma of eating meat. But as I mentioned, even in the time of the Buddha, the monks wouldn't turn away meat if they were offered that. They would have their alms bowl and receive meat and eat it. They wouldn't have any qualms and say, well, I'm sorry, I can't eat that meat because it's involved with the killing of a being. So it was obvious that there was already some, from the very beginning, an indication that eating meat is very different than the act of killing. So I don't know if I've explored everything around the restaurant situation, but...
Well, I was just wondering. Okay. It's confusing.
It is. All right, let's move on then and talk a little bit about this formula that is set out. Now, it's kind of interesting. Lewis Richman, when he talks about this energy wheel, he refers to it as, you know, a principle of continuous change. And I realized when I brought this in here that I forgot to put arrows on the inside there of this axis, arrows that really could go either way. He has them going in a clockwise way, but I think you could go in either way in terms of things changing. But this is really what our lives are like, particularly in the workplace, is that we constantly have changes in our lives, things that come and go, different scenarios that suddenly, you know, our life is different than it was even just a few minutes ago or a few seconds ago. And so this principle of continuous change, Lewis Richman says, is a central feature of Buddhist teaching, and its spiritual practices are in large part designed to help us grapple with it. And this is something that is a fundamental truth that the Buddha taught, that we're dealing with an impermanent world. Things are constantly changing. I mean, look at your own work life. We've had 3 work days this week. If you work Monday through Friday, has every day been exactly the same as the other days? No. So we know that it changes all the time. Continually new things that we're confronted with or that give us joy in what we're doing. So continuous change, he says, is a practical life problem, but it is also a core spiritual issue. How can we learn to embrace constant change in the details of our daily activity? And this is really what this principle of the energy wheel is all about. He says, over the centuries, and this I find kind of curious, generations of Buddhist monks have organized our various states of mind into a kind of map. And on this chart that you have in front of you is one modern version of that map called the energy wheel. Well, I'm not sure how many monks have organized things into this sort of thinking, but it is an interesting way of looking at what's going on in our minds. And it's just one format to examine this. I did this lecture out in San Jose at our center there. It's actually in Campbell. And one person, of course, is... land of high tech and what have you. You guys have a lot of high tech out here too, but you know, near Silicon Valley and all that. And one person came up to me and showed me an app that's called the Mood Meter. And it actually has these 4 quadrants on it in a sense with many different squares, and it's like 4 quadrants that you can map throughout the day where you are in regard to it. And it's got each one that you touch on, it's got an adjective to describe it. So it puts it in more of not just in terms of these 4 categories, but even flavors within it that go all the way out to extremes, if you will, of some of the experiences that we have throughout our day. So again, this can be applied in any type of avenue, but we're going to look at it tonight in regard to work, since this is the particular arena that we wanted to explore tonight, is during our work life, dealing with that continuous change. What are the various things that come up in terms of our mind state? Or again, as this app said, you know, our mood, kind of like a mood ring. I don't know if you remember mood rings. Okay, so this is, again, one way of looking at this. We've got 4 main areas here, conflict, inspiration, stagnation, and accomplishment. And they're divided into what we call their temperature, which in the case of the 2 on the top is hot. And in regard to the 2 in the bottom is cool. And let me give a little bit of why this is divided in this way. He says, the energy wheel is a way of organizing these various states of mind, you know, where we have one thing going from one thing to the next. And again, that's the experience that many of us have during the course of our work life or our social life, what have you. The axis of positive and negative divides the mind into states that are unpleasant versus those that are pleasant. Again, it's just a way of taking what the Buddha formulated as essentially two different feeling tones that we have. Ones that tend to be an unpleasant experience, those that tend to be a pleasant experience. Again, something that all Buddhist teachings pretty much acknowledge, that we will have those types of experiences, those feeling tones that are generated, that frequently cause us to have conflict in regard to those, the mind of anger and frustration and what have you that arises in terms of what is negative, the more uplifting states of mind in terms of what we experience that is positive or pleasant. He says here, you know, so for example, anger is qualitatively, I missed the one line. Then the axis of hot and cool, which I talked about earlier, having the hotter quadrants versus the cooler ones, is a description of the intensity of the energy. Again, I don't know that the Buddha talks so much about, you know, intensity of energy, but nonetheless, we can see that we do have some states of mind that are more highly charged than others. And we know this from our own experience, right? Because frequently they even cause a physical reaction, right? Things that are in the upper quadrant here that are much hotter, we might have physical effects from having those emotions. The heart starts beating, the adrenaline starts happening. Whereas down here, we almost tend to fall into a more lethargic state, so the energy is much lower. Again, just a way of organizing our mental landscape, what's going on in our minds throughout the course of a day. Throughout the course of even minutes sometimes. So he says here, so for example, anger is qualitatively a negative state, unpleasant, difficult, and painful, and quantitatively, anger is intense, highly focused, and energized. At the opposite end of the spectrum, a state of relaxation is pleasurable, as well as being spread out and diffuse, you know, not so highly charged. So the wheel represents the full range of our mental and emotional experiences. Of course, he talks about then how, even in the Buddhist teachings and what we practice in Buddhism, we tend to think that this is where we want to hang out, is down in that cool, positive zone, right? Where we're feeling much more relaxed, you know, calm, content, the mind not so troubled. And maybe this is what we get to on our cushion occasionally. But then, you know, we get up and we start dealing with the world and so do we maintain that kind of state of mind? So we have to acknowledge that while that may be where we would ideally like to be, we don't have much control over all the various factors that cause us to move from one quadrant to the next. So what we're going to do with the rest of tonight is kind of look at, and then again I'll add some teachings from Lama Zopa, but at least begin to get a feeling for how do we work with the mind when it's in these different states. Because these are, again, states of mind that the Buddha did talk about and give us some advice on how to confront them and work with them. Let me just share one more quote from here before we begin that discussion. Excuse me. He says, the wheel is a map of change and a guideline for continuous transformation. Every sector of the wheel can flow into any other sector. So, for example, the hot negative states we're going to talk about next is these, you know, anger, worry, fear, stress, can transform themselves into hot positive ones, such as inspiration and creativity kind of flowing over into that sector, that zone. You know, hot negative states can sometimes dissolve directly into cool positive ones, such as when a person who made us angry apologizes or a threat causing fear in us vanishes. So anger and worry can sometimes lose their energy and sink back into the cool negative arena of depression and defeat as well, which often happens when these emotions are not dealt with. So finally, any sector of the wheel can simply circle back on itself and persist for days, months, or years. So we can see any one of them transforming into any of the other three. We can also see them cycling back upon themselves, which is, of course, where it becomes really challenging because we keep encountering the same sort of stimuli that keep us in that zone, in that particular sector. So any questions on that before we go ahead and take a look at these? Do a deeper investigation. Yeah, Joan.
Do you think there's a relationship between this energy wheel and the wheel of life?
Yeah, the wheel of life, for those of you who don't know, is a outside on the wall there. It's a diagram that shows what are called the 12 links of dependent origination, dependent arising, as well as all the various states of existence that we take rebirth in, as well as the states of mind that cause that. You know, we've got all of the causes of suffering, the suffering we experience, the Four Noble Truths, in a sense, are even demonstrated by that. I don't know. I have thought about it, and I'm not sure that it fully encompasses it, because it tends to focus somewhat on the experiences that we're having, you know, which are more of what we might call the truth of suffering, or the reality that our minds are going to encounter various things that are somewhat karmically created and opportunities for new karma to arise, new mind states to arise. But we're looking at it from the point of view of how do we actually create the causes to not have our habitual ways of reacting to these come into play. So it's a similar tool to use to get in touch with all Four Noble Truths, with all the aspects that the Buddha taught in terms of how we attain liberation from these states. Can be used, yeah, absolutely, in a similar manner. Doesn't have all the ramifications of the Wheel of Life, obviously, because it's not talking about rebirth on the basis of, you know, these experiences, but it's definitely part of it. Yeah, we've got another question from Renee back there.
Not so much a question, but a comment.
Oh, sure.
When I see this, it reminds me a lot of Ayurvedic medicine. And when the Tibetan doctor was in town about a year ago, I don't know much about Tibetan medicine, but I asked him if there was a correlation between Tibetan and Ayurveda and or Chinese and the different Eastern forms of traditional medicine. And he said there was a lot of overlap between the Tibetan medicine and the Ayurvedic medicine. I don't know if the man who wrote this took any inspiration from that, but
Yeah, I don't know. Again, and I'm not sure that Lewis Richmond devised the energy wheel. He doesn't give credit to anyone else in the book, so I only know him as a source. And again, this is not divorced from everything the Buddha taught, because it is encapsulating these same sorts of ideas. And the medicine, as I understand it, in Tibetan Buddhism, well, everything is correlated in terms of states of mind and influences on various elements within our body and what have you. So, and then, of course, the effect of those elements sometimes on our mental states. It's an interdependent kind of phenomenon. So let's go ahead and explore this first sector. This first sector is the hot negative one. The overall category of this is conflict. I found it interesting when Lewis Richmond started talking about this sector, he said that there was a survey done once of what is the most stressful job. And he got various, somebody put together, some university put together, all these criteria for people to talk about aspects of their jobs so that they could determine what was the most stressful and what was the least stressful job. Any guesses as to what was the most stressful job? That would probably be up there. It wasn't on this particular survey. Policeman. Believe it or not, what they found was New York City taxi driver. Which I suppose, I don't know that I'd really want to be a New York City taxi driver. I'm not sure how they deal with it. Maybe things have changed to where some of these other occupations might take the lead when it comes down to it. But obviously any of those jobs where we are dealing with factors that change really quite frequently, or where there's a high importance put on what we're doing, such as air traffic controller, where you've got many people's lives in your hands in terms of the decisions you're making and trying to, you know, hold that all. What was interesting is that the one that they said was at the bottom of the list, and I didn't even realize this was necessarily an occupation, but it was mandolin maker. I mean, I've seen violin makers and any kind of musical instrument maker. They're very meticulous in what they're doing, right? And it's a long, drawn-out process. There's none of that sort of needing to crank them out and get the next decision made. It's actually very, very meditative in its own way. So I don't know if that's necessarily a universal truth for us to follow. But we can certainly see that if this is a part of our job on a regular basis, it can be a very challenging place to be. Now, some people feed off that kind of energy, maybe based on your own kind of mind state. You love to be in a high-stress environment where a lot of stuff is going on and may not find it to be as difficult, but a lot of people do certainly find it to be challenging. So let's talk a little bit about what the role in terms of bringing our spiritual path into this type of experience. First of all, to understand that when these sorts of things come up, when we have conflict in our workplace or in our whatever we're applying this to, we're really not helpless. And we tend to think, again, that if all the external stuff is happening, that we somehow have nothing we can do but go along for the ride and get totally captivated by it, totally caught up in it. And once more, we frequently create the same sorts of patterns. The patterns that come up are these four that are mentioned here, you know, of anger, fear, worry, stress. You know, they're not good places to be. They don't feel so good. And I think it's important to, you know, understand that, first of all, due to the fact that this is a wheel, the energy frequently changes. And it was just mentioned when I was going through in the book how they used anger as the example, or this conflict sector, how it can quickly move into other sectors. And sometimes we can even be the agent of creating that type of change. But sometimes it's because we're not necessarily looking at things in a much broader way at that time. We get kind of pigeonholed into a way of examining what's happening through a very tight lens. I mentioned this a little bit on the Sunday teaching. We have this kind of narrow mind that only sees it through our own experience of that difficult situation and thinking that there's no room for anything else to happen there. A lot of it, as I mentioned even on Sunday, has to do with how we're framing things and the sorts of thoughts we bring to something. And what I wanted to share with you is a story that Jack Kornfield tells about someone who was going through, I think he was a military officer, was going through mindfulness-based stress reduction, which some of you in the room have probably had some experience with. Mindfulness, again, is a very powerful tool to help us to be more aware of what's going on in our minds. And it was an 8-week course that this man was taking, and he was about 6 weeks into the course. And he decided on a day after work to go into the grocery store. And, of course, it's right after work. Everybody's in the grocery store. The lines are really long, and he's got his cart full of stuff. And there's quite a few people ahead of him, and he notices a few people in front of him. There's a woman, an older woman, holding a baby. And she's just got one item, two items, something like that. And, of course, his mind starts going in the direction of, well, why isn't she over in the express lane? What is she doing in this lane? She's just another person. It's going to make me later. I'm going to have to do. And then he realizes that he's going totally against the grain of what he's trying to learn in MBSR. And so he tries to put his practice, you know, into effect and calms his mind down, becomes much broader and, you know, feeling. And he's not so bothered by it any longer. They get further up, and now the woman who has the child in her arms is up at the very front of the line with the cashier, and the cashier is a younger woman. And all of a sudden, the older woman is handing the baby to the younger woman, and the younger woman is holding it up and causing it to laugh and doing all kinds of things. And, of course, he starts his mind going again. You know, what are they doing this for? I mean, look at all the people in line here. Look at all the people behind me. Look at me. Look at what's going on. So he gets totally perturbed and then realizes he's not practicing his mindfulness again. So he calms himself down, and the woman leaves with her child, and eventually he's up at the front. And by this time he's calmed down, and so he says to the woman that's the cashier, he says, oh, that woman who brought in that child, it was a cute baby, wasn't it? And she says, oh, you think so? He said, that's my son. And now that I work two jobs since my husband died, the only chance I get to see my son is when my mother brings him in for me to see him. So you get like a total shift, of course, in the perspective, because he wasn't privy to any of that knowledge and couldn't bring any of that type of awareness to where he was at when he was observing her at different places in the line, right? We don't know anyone else's story. We don't know what's going on for them. We don't know why they're in the predicament that they're in. We don't know why our boss is angry or why our coworker is upset. I remember I had someone I worked for, I really liked working for her in general, but she'd have these moods. I'd come in and all of a sudden she's in this mood, and I always thought she was upset at me. Like, how egocentric is that, right? And so I'd have these feelings like, you know, oh my God, well, what did I do? And go through all this whole process of self-examination and like trying to figure out if I did something or said something or some project that I didn't get done. And then, of course, I'd find out later that it was all something in her personal life that happened to just be spilling over into the workplace. And it wasn't directed at me personally at all. It was just like clouds passing through the sky, and eventually the sky clears. So again, I think that this is a really helpful perspective in dealing with some of the things that are in this quadrant, because if you have these sorts of experiences, again, they don't last. I can't imagine them not, you know, lasting forever, certainly, or even for more than some block of time. Maybe you have a really, again, high-stress occupation where that is more of what's happening than these other zones. But certainly, they're workable. These situations are entirely workable. We're not helpless. Of course, in dealing with stress, I think it's really good to have some techniques that we depend upon that help us to get back into a calmer place. If your workplace allows for that, maybe it's good to find a quiet place to sit. Maybe it's in the bathroom, perhaps, to sit on the toilet or something. You don't have to go to the bathroom. Just sit in the bathroom and do some quiet reflection to focus on the breath to get back to a more focused place so you can go back out and deal with the situation. The situations here can often be changed even by our way of confronting them and working with them. But they're not going to be solved if we just add more of the same type of energy to it. If we just come out and are angrier at the situation, angry at the people that caused it to arise and so on. You know, worry and fear are kind of interesting ones because, once more, we're coming from a place of our own insecurity and our own feeling like the situation prompts us to feel maybe incompetent, incapable, that things can't be handled, that we're going to, you know, lose out in the end. But, you know, it's interesting. Those places of vulnerability are actually great places of courage and strength. You know, they're opportunities for us. Of course, this is a big teaching in Buddhism, right, that everything is really an opportunity. Whatever we're confronting, we don't have to see it, again, as some sort of punishment we have to deal with, but rather it's an opportunity to work with our minds, to develop deeper qualities. So obviously, one of the main ones that we talk about in response to anger is developing patience. And I've already referred to Master Shantideva, who wrote an incredible work, the sixth chapter of which is on patience, the book called A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. And the chapter on patience gives us so many tools in the context of the Buddha's teachings to recognize what is going on, to not react to that with hatred and, you know, worry and fear and all kinds of responses that are simply not going to solve the situation. I'll share this one more time. I mentioned this on Sunday, this wonderful quote from that chapter by Master Shantideva, who essentially says, if it is a situation that can be remedied, well, there's no point in all the stress and worry and anxiety. Why? Because you put your energy into resolving it. So you come into work and all of a sudden everybody's all upset and somebody's yelling at you, your boss is yelling at you because something's not handled. Well, then don't sit there and get all bent out of shape. Know that you've got a task to do and put your energy into doing the task. If your boss comes in and there's something that, you know, there's nothing can be done about it, the shipment's already left or whatever's already happened, you can't do anything at this point to rectify it. Well, all of that stress and anxiety isn't solving the problem because it can't be solved. So we can see that Master Shantideva's advice, if it can be remedied, remedy it. If it can't, then we have to just acknowledge that. But there's no point in getting stressed out, no point in having any worry. So again, rather than those sorts of responses, it's important that we find a way to work with that anger. Again, I don't want to spend the entire evening talking about anger and how we deal with that. That's a whole other topic, and certainly there's many teachings out there. I actually really like Venerable Thupten Chodron's book, Working with Anger. It's really one of the most useful books, and I'm sure many of you in the room have used it. Working with Anger, it's called. Probably out in the bookstore, I imagine. It's a really popular book. Let's go on then to the next section, and then I'll check in a moment and see if there's some questions. I want to cover a little bit more before I do that. Stagnation, kind of moving down in this direction. We're staying on the negative axis here in terms of this is also potentially where we can get a bit stuck and feel like our day didn't go so well. So if you come home from work and the person you lives with asks you, you know, how was your day? If it was mostly in this half of the chart of the wheel, then this is what we kind of call having a bad day. But, you know, this is kind of an interesting one where it's not high energy any longer. Now we're down into the cool energy, the lower energy. We've got boredom, discouragement, even potentially failure that we're experiencing at work. And sometimes even depression. You know, I'll just tell a weird little joke that I heard many years ago from Carolyn Ray. She's a comedian. Do you know what the difference between boredom and depression is? She says, depression is when you think, oh my God, I'm going to die. And boredom is when you think, oh my God, what am I going to do until then? Anyway, sorry, I had to share that. But no, this is kind of like, again, a deeper mental state, because we're feeling very, again, lethargic. Everything is kind of drawing us down. We're not feeling the charge that we have even with the something like anger. So it's a little bit harder sometimes to maneuver through and to work with. Fatigue can set in. We might have a loss of energy ourselves. But this is also to be recognized as sometimes places where we actually can grow and flourish. You know, we talk about failure being on the list here. Well, failure is a label we put on something, right? You know, is there such a thing as a failure? How many people have never made a mistake in their lives and gained great success? Probably zero, right? Because the only way that we succeed, the only way that we actually grow as people, regardless of what occupation we're in, is by making mistakes, by learning from our mistakes. So failure or mistake or whatever is really opportunity. It's really something happening that gives us a chance to actually learn, to actually do something to improve our situation and our own knowledge. What's kind of interesting, this idea of boredom and the lack of engagement in what one does. Now, some of us might even have occupations where we're doing something repeatedly, doing something quite regularly, that it can become very boring, where you have regular tasks, regular forms that need to be filled out, regular files that need to be done, and what have you. There was an interesting survey that was done, a study by these two gentlemen. This was from the Greater Good website. Matthew Killingsworth and Daniel Gilbert sampled over 2,000 adults during their day-to-day activities. And what they found, this was a study in 2013, was that 47% of the time those individuals that were surveyed found that they weren't kind of mindful of their work. They were completely kind of tuned out to what they were doing. Their minds weren't focused on what they were currently doing. So that's pretty outrageous. When you think about, oh my God, if you were employing those people, if you had people you were paying to basically be only aware of what they were doing, engaged in what they were doing for 53% of the time, 47% of the time, they're kind of out of touch with it, unfocused, probably isn't a very good indicator of getting good productivity out of people. Again, and that's not something we're going to talk about tonight, but for ourselves, if this is a part of our day, a good part of our day, that we're kind of tuning out, that we're feeling disengaged, that we're feeling stagnant, again, we have to do something to change our minds in regard to that. It's a little bit harder to work with, but we do have to, you know, find ways to be present. Our Buddhist practice, what we're doing in on our cushion, should be something we can try to bring into the workplace, to be much more open and engaged with whatever's going on, to find new ways of looking at what's happening, to be able to utilize even those times of our day in a more beneficial way. The discouragement, you know, again, this idea, or depression even, I think, again, that we do have to find that there's some resources that we can develop within ourselves that allow us to have even a different state of mind in the midst of those types of experiences. And here I will share one more quote from Lewis Richmond. I'm not going to share much more from this book, probably not even anything more from this book. But this is where, once more, our intention, I mentioned this the other day, right? Our intention is so important in what we're doing. And in this tradition in particular, and this is something that jumps ahead even to what Lama Zopa Rinpoche talks about, that it's quite important that we set our intention at the beginning of our day, and that we remind ourselves frequently of what our intention is throughout our day. This will help us get through these kinds of stagnant periods of our day, because we realize that we still have something very vibrant and alive and worthwhile that we're trying to focus on in the midst of things being a bit dull and boring and what have you. He talks a little bit about ordinary intention and spiritual intention, and I like the way he phrases this. He starts off by recapping this old saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, or so the saying goes. We make a New Year's resolution to lose weight. We work hard at it for a few weeks, and then our effort lapses, and we are reduced to joking about it with our friends. Or we tell ourselves, this is the year we're going to learn Spanish. We buy some instruction tapes, and after a few weeks, the tapes just gather dust in our car's glove compartment. These are examples of ordinary intention, whose success or failure is measured by whether we meet our goal or not. But there is another kind of intention where attaining a goal is secondary, and discouragement is less likely. Spiritual intention is concerned not with short-term success, but with the long-term direction of our life. Whether we attain our goal is not as important as our firm commitment to stay pointed in the right direction. I think there was even a book by Chogyam Trungpa that was titled, The Path is the Goal. At some level, what we are doing through our practice day in and day out, whatever it looks like in terms of our environment, might be quite dull and boring, but because we are trying to stay in touch with a deeper spiritual intention, in this tradition, that intention being bodhicitta, being our desire to be of greatest benefit to others, to utilize this opportunity we have to fully awaken, when we have that as kind of our guiding intention, our spiritual intention, well, it's not measured in terms of what's going on again on the outside. It's not measured in terms of how excited we are about what we're doing. It's measured in terms of, are we staying true to that principle? Are we continually going back to that place and reaffirming that that's why we're there, that's why we're working, that's why we're watching TV, that's why we're eating a meal, that's why we're doing anything, is because we want to fully awaken. So we can use some of those periods of our life actually to get deeper in touch with these larger goals of spiritual intention so that we don't become discouraged because we're actually still on the path, still doing everything that we need to do. Again, a bit harder to move out of these sometimes, but we have challenges up here too. So any questions on this side of the wheel? Sorry, I keep moving this. This isn't quite sitting right on my ear, so keeps coming off. Yes. I forget your name. I know you from Light.
Joey.
Joey, that's right.
Yes. You had mentioned that on the cool negative, it tends to be the result of when issues are not being dealt with. When you look at the hot negative, it tends to be a result of what?
When issues are not being dealt with. So in terms of, again, you're saying that when issues are not being dealt with in regard to the first one?
The hot negative.
So what is it that's not being dealt with? Is that the question?
Well,
I'm sorry, I kind of missed it.
Had mentioned that the results of the cool negative was issues that hadn't been dealt with.
Uh-huh.
And to me, there's energy in the hot negative, so they're being dealt with somehow.
Uh-huh.
But not skillfully, I guess. But
right. Right. Maybe I didn't say that quite correctly. What I was meaning was that, again, all of these are potentially where we've got things arising, and we're usually going to deal with them in destructive ways, not so constructive ways, and we have to find ways to deal with them that are better. In terms of things arising that aren't dealt with, I don't know. I mean, I think, again, we could say any of these are, sure. Maybe it's just a different focus when it comes to, you know, in that quadrant. Yeah, I don't know. I think that, again, I really like what I shared the other day that's from Pema Chodron that essentially says that karma is life giving you the lessons you need to learn. So in essence, anything that's arising is something we haven't dealt with because we created that energy, that, you know, force of that karmic action in the past. It's come into our life now to remind us that we haven't done the work to make sure it doesn't come up again, you know. So at a deeper level, we can look at all these as kind of karmic teachings about what's ripening in our lives and what we might need to be dealing with to make sure that we resolve the situation once and for all, in a sense. But nonetheless, most of the work we do is on our minds because I think it's really hard for us to think about getting to a place where it's still doing it a little bit, but it just seems to be a little too tight tonight for some reason. That's okay. I'll deal with it. Yeah, thanks. Does that help a little bit? Yeah, anyway, sorry. Okay, anyone else? Questions on these two? On this kind of negative side? Again, if you want to share something from your own work experience, you can. We've got a little bit of time. I think I've got time to go through what we have left here. Okay, let's go on then to the other side. We're going to talk about the positive ones now. Let's begin kind of moving straight over to the accomplishment sector. This is when the energy level goes down because there's a sense of accomplishment in regard to what we've done, in regard to our workplace, in regard to whatever, you know, might be happening that makes us sort of rest for however much time until the next crisis comes or whatever. This is actually an interesting period because it can become a problem for us if we don't use it well. The things that we're encouraged to experience here or that are a part of that experience are generosity, and this is the main practice we want to try to do at this juncture. Contentment, this is a feeling that we have at that time, a sense of calm, a sense of relaxation. Of course, because of the low energy, we can sometimes get dragged down into it. Again, not really use that success and that feeling of accomplishment in a positive way. Once more, recognize that just as we talked about our spiritual intention over here, it also plays a role over there because the spiritual intention that we have in making sure that we use that experience of accomplishment, success, in a positive way is equally important. Now, what they encourage in terms of whether you're an individual and you're working on your own and you have that sense or whether you're with other people, is to really use it as an opportunity to develop a lot of positive qualities such as generosity, kind of gratitude, a real sense of connection to what one is doing at a deeper level in terms of the spiritual path, but even how once more that is an extension of what we're trying to accomplish, what we're doing in our work life, the results that we're getting. We can see that they are a product of the positive things that we're bringing into our lives. So the things that we have here, again, the dangers of complacency are there, the self-absorption, but if we actually use this as a time not to rest on our laurels, but to actually move that in a positive way, that positive energy, to share our experiences of accomplishment with others, to pay attention to what we're doing and how we do our work, this might be a good time to even reflect upon the accomplishments that we have had, to recognize the things that we need to put some energy into to improve in the future. I mean, one thing that's mentioned by Lewis Richmond in this category is the need to pay attention to our speaking and listening even. This can be an opportunity to do that because we can look back and say, well, what was it that brought me to that level of success or accomplishment? And frequently, it's acknowledging the ways in which we worked with others, the ways in which we connected with others through our communication, but also to recognize the ways that we can improve upon that, the ways that we can develop deeper bonds with others. So this is a place of support for ourselves, being humble, getting in touch with our own humility, not becoming big-headed on the basis of what we've accomplished, but rather to recognize this is an important time of actually collecting our energies for whatever else is going to be happening. So again, the dangers here are that kind of drawing down and the bit of the complacency that can come from that sense of accomplishment. The other one, on the other hand, is when we move back into the positive with the heat, the higher energy. So we're still in the positive vein, but these are much more energized experiences that we're having. The energy is there to spare, and we might even feel a bit magnified in ourselves and in the sense of engagement in our work. We call this the sector of inspiration. It's a place of creativity, ambition. It's kind of interesting. Lewis Richmond includes this idea of forgiveness in here, and we'll talk about that in a moment. This is also a place of great joy. Yeah, this is a place we like to be in too, and we talked about Buddhist practice earlier as being maybe that lower quadrant that's about accomplishment and bringing things into a calmer, cooler state. But we also really like being in this zone, and particularly people with professions where they feel like they've suddenly got free reins to be very creative and very inspired in what they're doing. That can be quite useful. The problem is with this sector is that things change again, right? It's very hard to stay in that sector. Even if you have your own business, you work with other people, right? You're not completely independent. You know, this is once more the interdependence of the world that we live in. You're dependent upon people as clients or as customers or in some way to be engaged with, and that's by virtue of having other folks involved, there's going to be change. It's not going to be always in that sector. So say you're somebody who does interior design and might be some people that you work for in some projects where you feel that strong sense of inspiration. And other times you're just so bored with the task. You know, it's like the person's just not enjoyable to work with in terms of what they would like is never in alignment with what you want to offer. So we can see that the problem here is that it's very hard to stay in that zone. And so there can be discouragement frequently just by virtue of falling out of that, because this is a good place for us to be generally. Another big problem that we have, of course, in this zone is that we do fall into that tendency to want more, to almost feel like we have to keep getting additional experiences in that vein to be satisfied. Like we want the next big challenge and the next big challenge after that that we can really sink our teeth into. And that's very hard to maintain as well. Frequently, wanting more is not really going to lead to, I'd say not even frequently, pretty much all the time. On our spiritual path, when we want more, maybe it's a different situation. But in terms of the world that we live in, wanting more is just simply a pattern that we fall into that has more to do with our desire, more to do with our attachment, more to do with that kind of concept like drinking salt water to quench our thirst, that we're continually looking for something more, hoping that it'll keep us entertained, keep us engaged. And that's really not, again, a helpful pattern to be in. So the usefulness of this time, of course, is the ability to kind of engage in other high energy activities that are positive. And that's why forgiveness is actually included in here. Now, why Lewis Richmond says that he includes this is he says this, he finds that the whole act of apologizing is actually a very high energy one. And of course, it's a very wholesome thing to be involved in, right? So this may be a time of, whereas the lower one with accomplishment that's positive might be a time of a bit of inner healing, this might be a time of greater outer healing where we actually can heal things with other people because we're in a much different place of inspiration and feeling good about ourselves, feeling good about the work that we're doing, and making sure that we engage in that type of behavior, especially if we are dealing with any other conflict with people in our workplace. Sylvia Boorstein, who some of you know, a great Buddhist practitioner and writer, she says in one of her books, quotes a Jewish rabbi that says that there are nine words that could change the world. Those nine words are, I'm sorry, I made a mistake, please forgive me. I think, again, that forgiveness, I sometimes do little talks on forgiveness. Forgiveness is a practice that I don't know that we do enough emphasis on in this tradition of Buddhism, but I think it is a very Buddhist practice. And when we look at it as being rooted in this idea of it being somewhat high energy, we can see it's a challenging one to do, right? It's challenging when we're confronted with somebody that we need to forgive, that maybe we have to go through our own process of, are we ready to forgive them? But when we have to apologize for our own mistakes, it also feels very high energy. But this is a place where we can actually engage in that because we're coming from a much different mindset. Rejoicing, joy, again, this is a common practice that's emphasized, making sure that we rejoice in other successes too, that we keep joy in all that we do. This is also a place where we shouldn't get too much into, you know, comparison with others, right? Judging others, but rather really try to influence others in a positive way. Because if we're feeling inspired, then we should be benefiting others from that place of inspiration rather than trying to bring them down by, you know, thinking that somehow they're not as good as us, they're not doing as well as us, or what have you. And there's a quote actually from Theodore Roosevelt that it says, comparison is the thief of all joy. You know, any joy that we have, the minute that we look at thinking that we're better than others or that some are worse than us or whatever, that's immediately kind of takes all the joy out of it. You know, what joy is meant to be shared. Joy isn't something that we should kind of keep to ourselves. It's really this sense of empathetic joy that we talk about in Buddhism, really feeling a joy with others, in sympathy with others, together with others. So each of these quadrants, again, has a different kind of energy tone and can be used to help advance a lot of these positive qualities, especially, again, these two that we've been looking at just now, where we really take delight in what we're doing, try to influence others in a positive way, try to look at how we're bringing our spiritual path into the workplace, because these are places where, again, we can become complacent. We think, oh, I must be doing fine. Everything's going well. Well, no, there's still things we need to work on, still things that we need to bring to mind. The problem over here, again, is more that when these things go bad, we don't necessarily think about applying our spiritual path. So we have to make sure that we bring in contrary states of mind, things that lift us up, that help us to have a more positive outlook in the midst of negative experiences. Any questions on those? Getting close to wrapping up, but particularly, again, the two on the positive side. But, yeah, Denise.
So is the implication of the book that, A, we would like to be in the orange, but it's just too hard to stay there, or that we would like to be on that black line between the orange and the blue?
I would say that it's not to be in any one of these specifically, but to recognize that we are going to be dealing with these probably for quite a while. I mean, again, the Buddhist path at its deepest level is to recognize that, again, we will have a change in our fundamental experience once we have purified our minds to that degree, once we have developed all the positive qualities to that degree. But in the meantime, we're going to float from sector to sector. We're going to go from experience to experience, again, sometimes very quickly. We might feel really good about our work. We're very inspired because we're working on a wonderful project. And as soon as we walk in the door, we get confronted with something that produces conflict. And then we resolve that. And then all of a sudden we realize that the project that we had isn't quite what we thought it was going to be, and we got some frustration with it, maybe even get a little bored by it. And then suddenly, you know, so it's more to have an even mind as we surf our way through these various sectors. I'd say that's the bigger goal and what he's really trying to point out in the book and in this use of this energy wheel, is to recognize that the energy is going to change, and we have to change our minds to accommodate that.
Reminds me of joyful effort and concentration, these two.
Yeah, they do. Again, when we get to sort of a deeper sense of contentment, calm, you know, through calming our minds completely, then all these things will arise, in a sense, in our horizon, but we won't have any experience of the agitation or anything that would arise from them. We'll have that sort of even mind. But initially, I can't say that's the goal, because I think that's an unrealistic goal. Until we have deeper concentration, until we put deeper effort into cultivating the path. So for now, it's just, you know, how do I surf? How do I actually make sure that when that wave comes along, I have something I can rely upon? It helps me to frame it in a context to recognize there's some energy there, to move it into change, to move it into something that could be quite useful, to learn from it, to recognize that this one has a different energy, and it yet can be very useful. Cool energy can be beneficial. Can be a place of deeper reflection and learning and coming to a deeper sense of spirituality and spiritual intention. And then again, what we saw in regard to the positive ones as well. Just a tool. Again, this is just meant to be introducing one tool. And what I'd encourage you to do is just to look at this and say, well, you know, maybe even pick one of these that you want. Maybe even examining your own day. Maybe you haven't been keeping track of your moods on the mood meter on your phone. But you have some idea of where you rest in this. Is your job mostly in which sector? And then on the basis of that, maybe pick a few of the things that we've talked about tonight and make a decision that you're going to begin to try to see it in that way. That when you start having that type of experience at work, that you're going to try to see it as a place of opportunity that you can learn from and grow from. Last thing I want to say before we conclude, we're at 8:30 now, but just emphasize again of what Rinpoche says. There's a wonderful article that is out there at the FPMT's website called Attitude for Our Work, and it's only 2 pages, and Rinpoche just makes the point of saying that our work life is, again, a really important extension of what we're doing on the path. He says, one must practice with the Bodhisattva attitude every day. You know, and this is, again, in this tradition, we really embrace this idea that we are there to benefit others. You know, our job, our family life, our social life, it's all about benefiting others. It's all about keeping in touch with that heart that is intent upon developing ourselves so we're better capable of serving others, better capable of leading them to happiness. So if we have that as our attitude, then it's pretty hard to get upset at people when some of these things come up. And it's really hard to get quite self-centered when we have more of the positive things coming up. We naturally open our hearts and try to extend ourselves to others to either help resolve situations that are more negative or to share in and make use of those positive situations in a much more kind of far-reaching dimension when we can really extend our own experiences to benefit others. So again, I won't say a whole lot more about that, but know that that article is out there and it's really quite interesting. Rinpoche, he says, before you go to the office, think, I'm going to practice Dharma. You know, the office is a place for all types of practice. And you can, even if you're working with a particular teaching, try to bring it to mind frequently. If you say you've been working with the teachings on patience, well, sure, you can bring those to work frequently, I'm sure. But even if you're working on trying to have a deeper understanding of suffering, well, guess what? You know, the workplace is all part of samsara, too. It's all part of our suffering. So just try to see it through that lens. I did write one little article for Mandala magazine. I was asked to contribute once, and they wanted me to write on kind of how to work with the Lam Rim in our daily lives. And so I actually borrowed an idea from Kendall Magnuson, who also is in the FPMT, who, when she teaches in the Discovering Buddhism module on a daily practice, says that you have to wear Lam Rim colored glasses. And this is kind of, you know, again, Rinpoche's idea is like you want to see everything that you experience through the lens of the Lam Rim, through the stages of the path. Well, that means that whatever it is that you're studying, you can bring that to mind. Yeah. You can do that while you're, I think I use the example even of while you're driving. We talk a lot about driving. Patrick was telling me that we should do a whole course on driving with the Dharma. You know, so I think there might be some usefulness there because that's where we spend a lot of time too, and a lot of that quadrant up here comes up when we're driving. Any final comments or questions from people? Yes, Lee.
I'm not really sure how to ask this. When you asked earlier about finding that congruence, I've had a lot of difficulty with that lately. I'm just wondering how to kind of shift into a more positive frame when you're in a situation where recently I've been in a situation where I've been under a lot of criticism by my employer, and some of it I felt wasn't really justified, and I come to this place of feeling like, well, there's a certain point where for your own survival, you know, there's this sort of just to survive, there's this, you know, I have to protect, there's a part of me that needs to stand up for myself, and that's something that's is, I don't know if that's really true in the Dharma, if but you know, just practically speaking, I find that I can't really go into that place where I need to stand up for myself and be in a positive state at the same time. I don't know how to... I'm just wondering how to... When you're facing... I don't know how to ask, you know, how to kind of shift in those positive into those positive states when you're being... When your livelihood is almost at stake, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, we have to acknowledge that it's tricky. It's tricky maneuvering between that. But if we have a strong spiritual basis for kind of why we are doing what we're doing and make sure that that's to the degree that we're really in touch with that, then I think it becomes a matter of acknowledging that we don't want to buy into the negative states that are contrary to what we're trying to accomplish on our spiritual path. So it doesn't mean that we can't do anything, and that we become, you know, just paralyzed by the situation, and we can end up again with no real recourse in terms of trying to correct the opinion somebody might have of us, trying to make sure that they know the work that we're actually doing or whatever it might be. But we do that with a different state of mind. This is, again, I think it was actually, there was a little bit in his book where he's making reference to His Holiness's book, Healing Anger, that I talked about the other day. he says, if one has been treated very unfairly and if the situation is left unaddressed, it may have extremely negative consequences. Such a situation calls for a strong counteraction. Under such circumstances, it is possible that one can, out of compassion for the perpetrator of a crime or whoever it is that we're working with, I mean, he's talking maybe about more serious situations in some ways, but anybody who is kind of not seeing things correctly or in a state of mind where they're potentially creating more negativity, is it's possible that you can, out of compassion for them and without generating anger or hatred, actually take a strong stand and take strong countermeasures even. In fact, one of the precepts of the Buddhist vows is to take strong countermeasures when the situation calls for it. If a Buddhist doesn't take strong countermeasures when the situation requires, then that constitutes an infraction of one of the vows. So the idea here is that we can find the opportunity to do that, but to make sure that we have the right spiritual platform to come from to do that means we have to be really in touch with compassion, always looking at things through that lens, that why we are talking to somebody to address their misunderstanding isn't coming solely from a self-centered place. It's not coming from a place of you're wrong, I'm right, and I need to set you right, and, you know, full steam ahead. It's rather coming from the place of having compassion for them and making sure that you're doing this to help them to also have deeper understanding, more qualities, greater connection, to develop more harmony in the workplace, whatever the case might be. When you have a wider perspective for what you're doing, then you can go about that activity hopefully from a much different place. It's not going to sound like, oh, Lee's angry and she's coming into my office to say this. It's going to sound like, oh, here's an employee that has some genuine concerns that are about everything, about, you know, not just her situation, but about how we have greater integrity in the workplace and so on. So I don't think it's impossible. It's hard, difficult. But once more, the strength to which we work with our own compassion on the cushion and our own understanding will bring that into the workplace. I'd encourage you even, I mean, this is one thing I encourage people to do frequently, is to meditate on some of these situations. If you have a regular situation in your workplace that needs to be dealt with, bring it into your meditation and really have it in front of you and think about what are the skills and abilities you need to handle that constructively, compassionately. And sometimes things become very evident to you in that reflection, because we do have the raw stuff to draw from. We just frequently go to the default modes of getting angry or upset and not finding those ways of genuinely connecting with others. I don't know. Might take more than just those few words I've given you, but I wish you well with that, because it is difficult. The Buddhist teachings don't mean we do nothing, you know, or just accept everything. Because again, if we also have a concern for others and them abiding by the truth and them doing things well and doing things compassionately, then we want them to learn from that as well. And so it's a mutual learning experience. Yeah.
Would you mind, which vow is that?
I think he's talking technically about the bodhisattva vows more than the lay vows. In this book, it was on page 62. In Healing Anger, I think it's towards the beginning in that book, which is, again, His Holiness's commentary on the patience chapter of Shantideva that I mentioned earlier. But
thank you very much.
Sure, thanks, Lee. I think we need to conclude, because we're already a few minutes after. So let's just do two short prayers to dedicate all the positive energy that we've created here through tonight. I think you've got the prayer books there. Let's go to page 235. We won't do the one that I like from Shantideva, but rather these two. Thinking that everything, all the seeds that we planted, everything we've heard, all the thoughts that we've had, all the discussion we've engaged in, all of this is going to become the cause for the enlightenment of all beings. And then really dedicate yourself to following this path of the bodhisattva, to developing bodhicitta, and to wanting to help others to cultivate that same mind. So we're going to recite the first two prayers again on page 235. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. Then just have a few brief thoughts for dedicating for the lives of our precious teachers for their good health. I can think in particular about His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Lama Zopa Rinpoche and the resident Geshe's here, as well as all the spiritual teachers that we and others are following in our lives. May we never be parted from such perfect guides in all our lives, and may all beings know perfect guides. Thank you all so much. It was really enjoyable going through tonight's class in particular, as well as all of my time here. It went very quickly. It's sad that it's come to the conclusion, but I'll look forward to seeing a lot of you at Light of the Path this year. My plan is to be there for the full 4 weeks, so whenever you show up, if you're not able to do the whole retreat, I'd be happy to see you and say hello. So anyway,
yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Don, on behalf of Kadampa Center, I'd like to thank you very much for coming. It was both educational, inspiring, and delightful having you here. And we do look forward to seeing you at the Light of the Path, and we humbly request that you return to Kadampa Center quickly.
Thank you. I'd be happy to. We'll see how my schedule unfolds, but I'll certainly keep that in mind.
Thank you. And may people come up and offer katas?
If they so desire.
Okay, thank you.